Starvation has been a way of life in India for well over 100 generations. Starvation and misery. Such abject poverty has come to seem to be the normal way of life, as if it were part of God's original design, which of course it was not. Settlement first appears in India. The settlers find a rich and fertile land, great river valleys, rich alluvial plain, deep forests on the mountainside, a land bursting with mineral wealth, a land which, if carefully tended and husbanded, might cradle a gracious and gentle civilization. But some men wanted what other men had. So armies were sent across this land, marching and countermarching, ravishing and ravaging. And the troops trampled down the irrigation dikes. The troops cut down the vines and the fig trees and the rich fruit trees. They despoiled the earth. And they killed off the men who tilled the earth. And other men were greedy. They wanted the earth to yield twice, three times the normal harvest. And they tilled the fields year in and year out, season by season. They forgot to replenish the earth. They didn't allow the fields to lie fallow, to grow rich again. Then conquerors came to India, and they brought with them cattle and the herds. The cattle cropped close the grass in the highlands. And the goats crop the narrow tendrils and the shallow roots of the trees. And soon the earth had been loosened from the crust of the world. And soon the upper reaches of the mountains were barren. The trees no longer contained the spring rains, and there were floods in the deep valleys. But it was once a rich and fertile land, little by little, yielded less and less to more and more. Poverty became the normal way of life and has remained so unto this day. Abject poverty exists in India not because of God's miserliness, but because of man's mischief. The lesson of India can be repeated again and again as we look down the long chronicle of history. For whenever a great nation has fallen, a great empire has gone under, it says less about the vigor of its manhood or the talent of its people. These tend to remain rather constant in the genetic mix of a country. But it tells us a great deal about the carelessness and the greed with which men have abused their natural environment and fouled their own nest, the world in which they live. Look at history. To read history in these terms is to despair of progress. There is not a nation in all of recorded history which has, in the long run, protected its virgin forests, conserved its natural resource, maintained the tight and rigorous disciplines which human beings must maintain if we are to survive with any degree of grace and amenity in this glorious world with which God blessed us. Now, we cannot even plead ignorance. The early man, the early Indian, the early Roman, the early Greek, the early Hebrew was unaware of the laws of nature. To read the ancient law codes, to read our own Bible, is to recognize that very early man who lived on the soil recognized the requirements of the soil. He knew what was required of him. So we read in our Bible that when armies are in the field, they may not cut down the fruit trees for siege weapons, for scaling ladders, because both the conqueror and the conquered will require the harvest of the fruit, will require the shade, will require the roots holding the soil to the earth, if there is to be any life in these surroundings. Similarly, we read in the Bible that when one comes upon a well untended, one does not know whether that well belongs to one's own tribe or to neighboring tribes or to the enemy. One may drink of the well. We must be very careful to place back the capstone, the seal, the stone seal that held the well fast, lest the weather, the winds bring the debris and the dust, and the well silt over and be incapable of giving the mayim chayim, the living water, to any who might require it. Men have known since most ancient times that the soil imposes obligations upon us, and that any who flaunt these duties despoil the good earth, destroy the ability of the earth to sustain all life, including their own. I remember when I first became conscious of pollution, of man's greed and man's callousness, of our greed and our callousness. When I was growing up, we lived by Lake Erie. One of the first warnings I can remember was the warning, you may not swim in the lake. The lake is dirty. And it was a natural and wise parental rule. Less than 100 years after men had first settled on these shores, we had turned our greatest natural asset into a cesspool. I remember sitting by Lake Erie as a youngster, coming alive and aware of the problems of the world, reading one of the books which made a great impact on me as a child, The Ant's View of Civilization, The Life and Times of Archie and Hittabel. Remember it? It came out around 1935. Don Marquis wrote it. It's a series of letters sent by the ant to his one human friend in which he comments from underneath about the quixotic nature, the bestial nature, the stupidities and follies of men. This is one of the letters. Let me read it to you. Dear boss, I was talking with an ant the other day. He handed me a lot of gossip which ants the world around are chewing among themselves. I pass it on to you in the hope that you may relay it to other human beings and hurt their feelings with it. No insect likes human beings. And if you think you can see why, the only reason I tolerate you is because you seem less human to me than most of them. Here is what they're saying. It won't be long now. It won't be long. Man is making deserts on the earth. It won't be long now before man will have used it up so that nothing but ants and centipedes and scorpions can find a living on it. Man has oppressed us for 1,000,000 years, and he goes on steadily cutting the ground from under his own feet, making deserts, deserts, deserts. We ants remember. We have it all recorded in our tribal lore. When Gobi was a paradise swimming with men and rich in human prosperity. It is a desert now, in the home of scorpions, ants, and centipedes. What man calls civilization always results in deserts. Man is never on the square. He uses up the fat and greenery of the earth. Each generation wastes a little more of the future with greed and lust for riches. North Africa was once a garden spot. And then came Carthage and Rome, and it despoiled the storehouse. And now you have Sahara. Sahara. Ants and centipedes. Toltecs and Aztecs had a mighty civilization on this continent, but they robbed the soil and wasted nature. And now you have deserts, scorpions, ants, and centipedes. And the deserts of the Near East followed Egypt and Babylon and Assyria and Persia and Rome and the Turk. The ant is the inheritor of Tamerlane, and the scorpion succeeds the Caesars. America was once a paradise of timberland and stream, but it is dying because of the greed and money lust of 1,000 little kings who slashed the timber all to hell and would not be controlled, and changed the climate and stole the rainfall from prosperity, for prosperity. And it won't be long now, it won't be long till everything is a desert, from the Alleghenies to the Rockies. The deserts are coming. The deserts are spreading, the springs and the streams are drying up. One day the Mississippi itself will be a bed of sand ants and scorpions and centipedes to inherit the earth. Men talk of money, an industry of hard times, recoveries of finance and economics, but the ants wait, the scorpions wait, for while men talk, they are making deserts all the time, getting the world ready for the conquering ant,
drought and erosion and desert, because men cannot learn. Rainfall passing off in flood and freshet, and carrying good soil with it because there are no longer forests to withhold the water in the billion reticulations of the roots. It won't be long now. It won't be long till earth is barren as the moon and sapless as a mumbled bone. Dear boss, I relay this information without any fear that humanity will take warning and reform. Signed, Archie. 1935. 1970. I picked up the other day the handbook on environmental, from environmental crisis, which is designed as a series of readings for environmental teach-in, which is planned for the 22nd of April. And I found this little familiar section as the frontispiece of the book. A statement by the very need of such an environmental crisis activity. That man had in fact not reformed and taken warning. And that if anything, we had accelerated the pace in which we were wasting God's natural treasure and natural legacy to us, and destroying and despoiling the environment in which we live. For it's now not only a question of too many people sprawling over the countryside, pouring out their waste carelessly, destroying the timberland, destroying the riverbeds, destroying the farmland. But now we have discovered 100 new technological marvels which we spew out upon the earth. Pesticides and herbicides, all manner of chemical defoliants, detergents that we put into our wash, all kinds of chemicals which will not break down and simply disappear, which poured into our water, spewed into our air, dropped on our land, to spoil forever the richness with which God originally invested it. So there we are. Reform, change, so very little. So very little has happened. So that this land, so rich, just a few years ago, a natural resource, finds itself today in a crisis. Crisis brought on by nature, which always has the last word. A crisis brought on by our abuse of God's blessing. And that lake beside which I sat 35 years ago, that lake is now today not only dirty but dead. A dirty lake is a lake in which children may not swim and into which we must pour chemicals before the waters become potable. A dead lake is a lake in which the fish cannot spawn. It is a lake whose waters are inert, lacking now the capacity to act as one of nature's great cleansing agents to bring clear air and clear water to the environment. A dead lake is a lake heavy in phosphorus and nitrate poured upon the surrounding shores by man, which destroy the living organisms in the lake, which change the sunlight into food for living organisms, and so provide the beginning of the cycle of feeding which supports life within the lake. A dead lake ceases to be a life support for man. It threatens us because it withdraws from us one of the treasuries from which we must draw in order to survive. And Lake Erie is not an anomaly, not unique. It's only the first of the major waterways in the United States to die. The others will follow soon. Dr. Barry Commoner, the Dean of the Ecologists of the United States, says it's a matter of 15 years, 20 years at most, before all the major lakes on this continent, all the major waterways, the Mississippi and the Ohio and the Missouri and the Colorado, the Hudson, the Potomac, all of them, become open gutters, gray, inert, dead. Now, there are those who say, whenever we talk about this future, well, so what? We'll build swimming pools instead of swimming in the open waters. We'll find stronger chemicals to make the waters drinkable. We always have the ocean. Oh, you talk to me so much, you Jeremiahs, you talk to me so much of overpopulation and of the despoiling of nature. But we have all the technical marvels, and beyond that, beyond this, we have the oceans, the open seas. I've read about hydroponics. I know that the oceans can be farmed. Surely here we have an unlimited reservoir of natural resource of food with which to sustain man. Do we? I
read an article the other day by Dr. Paul Ehrlich, professor of biology at the University of Stanford, California. He entitled this article, Eco Catastrophe, Ecological Catastrophe.
And it begins with this simple sentence. The oceans died in the late summer of 1979. Not 2179 or 2079, but 9 years from now. And Dr. Ehrlich is not writing shocking fiction. He's attempting what the scientists call a scenario. That is to extrapolate from what exists today, logically and scientifically, to its inevitable conclusion. And his conclusion is that in 9 years, the oceans too will cease to be part of the feeding cycle which supports life upon this earth. We have dammed the freshwater rivers so that the fish can no longer spawn. We've created electronic and mechanical and technological marvels with which to fish the great fishing banks so that we have denuded them of their annual crop. We have poured the DDTs and the chemical wastes and the industrial waste into the ocean and polluted the shorelands, which support a great deal of the plankton, which supports life in the seas. We have turned the estuaries of our great rivers into open sewage pits, no longer capable of supporting life. The oceans, which cover two-thirds of this globe, are one of the great cleansing agents placed upon this globe to clean the atmosphere of the dirt. But inert waters cannot cleanse. They are dirty and polluted in and of themselves. Now, Dr. Ehrlich is of the doomsday school of ecologists who believe that time has run out on us. It's too late. Most other ecologists do not. The very fact that they can talk scientifically, logically, about turning the oceans into a desert. There will always be water there, but the water will be dead as far as life is concerned. The very fact that they can talk in these terms should make all of us shudder and recognize that we are dealing here with a kind of technical and industrial and personal crisis. To require every energy which this nation and all the nations of the world can summon. Let me read to you briefly from Dr. Ehrlich's conclusion. Right now, fisheries are being wiped out by overexploitation, made easy by modern electronic equipment. The companies producing the equipment know this. They even boast in advertising that only their equipment will keep fishermen in business until the final kill. Profits must obviously be maximized in the short run. Indeed, Western society is in the process of completing the rape and murder of the planet for economic gain. And sadly, most of the rest of the world is eager for the opportunity to emulate our behavior. But the underdeveloped peoples will be denied that opportunity. The days of plunder are drawing inexorably to a close. Most of the people who are going to die in the greatest cataclysm in the history of man have already been born. More than 3.5 billion people already populate our moribund globe. About half of them are hungry. Some 10 to 12 million will starve to death this year. In spite of this, the population of the Earth will increase by 70 million souls in 1970. For mankind has artificially lowered the death rate of the human population, while in general birth rates have remained high. With the input side of the population system in high gear, and the output side slowed down, our fragile planet is filled with people at an incredible rate. It took several million years for the population to reach a total of 2 billion in 1930, while a second 2 billion will have been added by 1975. By that time, some experts feel that food shortages will have escalated the present level of world hunger and starvation into famines of unbelievable proportions. Other experts, more optimistic, think that the ultimate food population collision will not occur until the decades of the 1980s.
The worldwide plague and thermonuclear war are made more probable as population growth continues. These, along with famine, make up the trio of potential death rate solutions to the population problem. Solutions in which the birth rate, death rate imbalance is redressed by a rise in the death rate rather than by a lowering of the birth rate. Make no mistake about it, the imbalance will be redressed. The shape of the population growth curve is one familiar to the biologist. It is the outbreak part of an outbreak crash sequence. A population grows rapidly in the presence of abundant resources, finally runs out of food or some other necessity, and crashes to a low level or extinction. Man is not only running out of food, he is also destroying the life support systems of the spaceship Earth. The situation was recently summarized very succinctly. It is the top of the ninth inning. Man, always a threat at the plate, has been hitting nature hard. But it is important to remember that nature bats last. Now, many will disagree with Dr. Ehrlich that this is the top half of the ninth inning. It is certainly the seventh inning. And we hope not simply a seventh inning stretch before we sit down again to continue as we have done. For the problem is not simply overpopulation. It's problem enough. The problem is that we have escalated our demands. Since 1930, we have each of us begun to consume five times as much of the Earth's resources as we required in that year. Each of us is five times the predator that he was just 40 years ago. We represent, you and I, 5.7% of the population of this Earth, that is the United States. We consume 40% of the consumables which are ingested, used, destroyed by man in the course of any given year. One of the great problems which has arisen is that we have escalated our appetites. What we once thought were luxuries have become necessities. And often these necessities have become the enemy. I give you the American automobile. We have already paved over in the United States an area of land equal to all of New England. We spew from our cars into the atmosphere the exhaust which creates the smog, which we breathe, which brings emphysema, which stimulates cancer. The life expectancy curve in the United States, which, as you know, was rising steadily through the early decades of this century, around 1960 began to level off. Our children will have a less chance of a long life than we had. The fumes, the smog, is in their lungs. It has been translated into their blood systems. And so it goes. We're going to have to begin to look at ourselves for what we are. Earthbound creatures whose way of life, whose abundance, whose so-called gracious living is really greedy living. We're going to have to begin to recognize that an entirely new approach to our lifestyle is required of all of us. What's demanded of us? In the first instance, the scientists must find ways in which to recycle human and industrial waste so that the things which we mine from the earth and extrude from its minerals, these things are not wasted, used once, and tossed away to become junk which blights our countryside. And we're going to demand of our scientists a far more scrupulous science, responsibility, than they have heretofore undertaken. For they have been asked by industry, is a detergent safe? And they answer, yes, it is safe. It's safe to the hands of those who are operating the washing machine and the dryer. But because they were not asked, is it safe for the city? Is it safe for the waterways into which the sewage of the city is exhausted? They didn't bother to answer that question. Industry would not have paid them their salary if they had. And so the detergents were poured into the rivers, and the rivers were clogged, and the rivers became lifeless,
were asked about fallout. And they were told that there were certain standards of tolerance which we had within our human body. But it didn't say what happened from generation to generation, nor did they examine what happened to the fallout which fell upon the grass, which was eaten by the cows, which turned the grass into milk, the milk feeding our babies taking strontium and other chemicals into their systems, into their bone structure, into their genes. Much more must be demanded of the scientific community to alert us to the complex of technical problems which the so-called miracles of science have created for us. And much more must be demanded of our government. The whole business of living within this continent, living with some amenity, with some concept of conservation of natural resources, must be made an urgent, a primary national urgency. Much more important to save life on this earth than to spew our garbage onto the moon. But we waste billions to race to the moon, and we have yet to invest our first $10 billion in trying to save the resource of this nation. And there must be certain priorities as to governmental policy. It's not enough for a president's wife to be concerned with the beautification of the landscape. All well and good, but that's a band-aid which masks the cancer. The cancer is the road. The cancer is the sprawling city. The cancer is the human waste which we pour out every day. The cancer is the industrial pollutant which every plant discharges from its ovens and from its kilns and from its furnaces. All these must be regulated. Industry must be made to accept responsibility for all that leaves its factory, including the ultimate reduction, recycling of the product which it produces. And we, the consumers, must be prepared to bear the increased cost. We must require through our government far more stringent regulation of the smoke which belches into the air. We must require of our government the investment of millions of dollars in fundamental research in biology and ecology, similar sciences. We must allow our scientists to be taken off military hardware and space hardware and put on the hardware of required by the mere responsibilities of environmental survival. We must see to it that we no longer look to solving our problems of transportation by building more roads. Typical of the confusion in the country is what could be seen in our paper this morning. On the one hand, a great complaint that we couldn't find ways of building a new superhighway around the city, which would take more acres of land and reduce it to cement, and pour more pollutants into the air and reduce the ability of the surrounding greenery to purify the air and to perform the essential life-giving task of photosynthesis. At the same time, there was a great article about how all the riverways and the shoreways of Europe have become open gutters, lifeless and inert. And we can see this confusion in our own government. On the one hand, the president has been talking of late about debt to our environment. He has asked some hundreds of millions of dollars to build a certain number of new sewage systems around the country, but he has also at the same time ordered the release of almost $1 billion for immediate highway construction. The right hand knoweth not what the left hand doeth. We are still building dams in our streams to contain the water, which restrain the fish from coming up and spawning in those streams. There's no greater dam in the world than the dam being built on the upper Nile, Aswan. This dam is about to be completed. When it was projected, the Egyptians were told that so many hundreds of millions of acres would be made fertile below the dam in southern Egypt. What no one told the Egyptians, and what is in fact proving out to be true, that the salinity of the upper Nile has so far increased that they can no longer farm on the Nile from the Mediterranean to the dam. That they have lost as many acres of arable land as they will gain. and that the great fishing industry on the Mediterranean has been imperiled because the silt which now comes down the river is one to which it has not been able to adjust. We need far more careful advice, scientific advice, as to those major projects which we as a nation undertake. But most of all, you and I are going to require a new understanding of what is required of us. It's no longer enough simply to love children. We must seriously ask, how many children can we legitimately have? It's no longer enough simply to look upon a car as an extension of our personality. We must be willing to engage in socialized travel, mass transportation, which will leave us off a block or two from where we want to go and not take us directly there or to that parking lot which is 7 blocks away from where we wanted to go in the first place. We're going to have to live with people and share the ability to move and share the amenities of the system, rather than each of us demanding that we create a total miniature little world with everything in it just for ourselves. We can't afford it, the nation can't afford it, and nature won't allow it of us. God gave us a gracious earth. There's an old midrash which says that when God created this earth, he took Adam and Eve up to a great cliff which overlooked the world. And he said, look out. There's the green forest, and there's the blue water, and here's the sun, there's the rain. I have given you all that you require for a gracious life. Go out and work it. Be my partners in the task of creation. What would we see if we went up to that cliff today? The cut down forests, tree stumps, the blackened seashore lined with fish, dead, bloated, the gray sea floating with flotsam, the spill of oil we attempted to dredge from beneath it, rain sometimes dark, the dirt of the air, sunlight sometimes covered with the smog which we have blasted into the air. The resources of this world are not unlimited. Our ability to despoil this world is unlimited, and we have put few limitations, few disciplines on ourselves. And there you have it. We have a crisis. A crisis of worldwide proportions. Will we meet it? Or will we allow the environmental crisis to become another children's crusade? Another thing we let our children talk about and teach in about and demonstrate about, and because they are talking about it, we do nothing about it. It will escalate the language. The rhetoric may make the crisis seem more total than it really is. Many of us have tuned them out, and so we immediately tick off and put down anything they say as not worth listening to. But we didn't listen to Don Marquis, to the Ant, 35 years ago. And we haven't listened to the Barry Commoners and the ecologists, the grown-up, mature scientists of, over the last 20 years. Who else can make us listen? Are we willing to hear? Are we willing to be serious? Because the shoe will pinch. Industry will, the profits of industry will have to be put into terms which will do good for the entire community. Things will cost more. There will be less things to go around. More things will need to be shared. Are we willing to pay the price? Would we rather pay the ultimate price and bequeath to our children, if we live that long, a world which has been denuded and despoiled and turned into the desert for the ant, the scorpion, and the centipede. Amen.